Hello and welcome to today's Lampside chat about adaptive expertise in teaching, which will be recorded and shared. I'm Stuart Keim from EBE, and today my wonderful colleague, Rob Coe, and I will explore the concept of adaptive expertise, asking what is it and how can we get more of it in schools? And we'll think together about how adaptive expertise differs from routine expertise, and why it's essential for educators to learn how to adapt their techniques and approaches to meet diverse classroom challenges equitably. During the conversation, we'll put particular focus on the Great Teaching Toolkit and the ways in which it's designed to support teachers on the journey from developing routine to adaptive expertise. And we plan to get stuck into the balancing of theoretical knowledge with practical skills, discussions of context-specific autonomy and creativity, and the development of judgment and intuition in the classroom. And our aim today is for all of us here today, wherever you are in the world, and those watching back later, to get better together, to share expertise, to ask questions, to think hard together. So to that end, please do share questions in the Q&A panel, and we will pick up as many of them as we possibly can. So let's get started. Rob, you've talked about the concept of adaptive expertise as something that is crucial for teachers to have to apply practical techniques effectively in varying situations. So what is adaptive expertise? Let's define our terms.
Yes, it'd be good to be clear about that, wouldn't it? And I've talked about it, but lots of other people have talked about it. It's become a bit of a thing, I think, that we think we've sort of discovered this new idea, or an important idea at least. Maybe there's a bit of novelty. What is it? Well, on one level, I think it's the obvious thing between, you know, something that's routine is you can apply in a particular, you learn a skill and you can do that skill. But can you do it in a different way? Can you do it in a different context? Can you do it with a different topic or a different class or a different some other aspect of difference that you want to apply it to? And being able to adapt, and I suppose underlying this is also the idea of lethal mutations that people talk about. So sometimes people are quite anxious about adaptation, that they think people have to be given quite sort of strict constraints, recipe, so that they're not able to adapt. So there's all these different views about, but in research terms, the idea goes back to, or at least what gets so cited most often, is a chapter by Hatano and Inanaki in a book about Japanese education from the 1980s. And it's, I'm pretty sure that no other chapter in that book ever gets cited by anyone.
Oh, is the rest of it not very good?
Well, I haven't read the rest of it. That's the point. I don't think anyone has. And some people will have read this particular chapter, but I think many others will either have glanced at it or just cited it because it's what everybody cites. So it has a lot. It's got something like 1,700 citations on Google Scholar.
Right.
When you read the chapter, there's almost nothing in it. It talks about, they do define this distinction between adaptive and routine expertise. They describe what it means. The main difference is that adaptive expertise means you can explain why something happens as opposed to just do it.
Mm-hmm.
But the context they're talking about is really about children's education in Japan.
Okay.
So the expertise refers to the learners, the students, children learning in the classroom.
Okay.
And for me, the resonance when I read that is all about procedural versus conceptual understanding, which is a huge volume of literature, still quite contested, particularly in maths education, about the balance or the conflict or the priority or, you know, the ordering. Should we do procedural first and build conceptual on it? Yeah, or do we have to start with conceptual? All these debates are still live, I would say, in relation to the learning of mathematics. And really interestingly, also in this chapter, they conclude by basically criticizing their current Japanese system as being too, as they call it, efficiency oriented. which is the procedural routine. In other words, they teach children to be able to follow routines, but not enough about what they then call understanding oriented, which is the adaptive.
Yeah.
So being able to explain why.
Yeah.
And by implication, being able to apply that to other kinds of problems.
Yeah.
So it's really saying we in Japan need to be more like other countries like the US and UK at that time, who were getting really into sort of investigative and other kinds of discovery type approaches, how they were teaching mathematics. And there was a perception that countries like Japan were a bit too sort of narrow and needed to move towards this other thing. Now, that's really interesting, isn't it, in the context of 40 years later, where a lot of people are sort of thinking a bit the opposite, or there's been this whole narrative about explicit teaching and how we know that that children need to have these skills internalized. We do need to have number facts and all that kind of stuff. But I think everybody agrees we need to not stop there.
Yeah.
So that's rather a long answer to this question, but I think it's quite interesting, this background.
Yeah.
For me, the literature that is relevant is, again, a really long-standing, really controversial field of psychology, which is about far transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, hotly contested, because the whole point of going to school is far transfer. You know, you learn about history, which might be the Tudors or it might be the Romans or whatever. And the idea is that by doing that, you learn skills that can be transferred in other contexts. Mm-hmm. It's the same argument is made about university education, the same argument about maths or, you know, any other subject.
Yeah.
At the back of it is this idea that what you're learning isn't purely important per se. Some of it might be.
Yeah.
But it's also important for the sort of transferability.
Yeah.
You learn these skills that are transferable, supposedly. Okay. And yet when psychologists have tried to find evidence for it, they've had a very mixed success and quite often failed to find this elusive far transfer.
Okay.
So this is slightly long and then I'll get
this, to... This is really, really, really long. I hope this... Stay with it.
Yeah, this will be the longest answer to any of your questions, I promise. So one of the studies I really like in that literature is right back to 1908, I think, Charles Judd, who was one of the sort of founders of psychology as a science as we know it. And he did this really nice little experiment where he got kids to throw darts at a dartboard that was underwater.
Okay.
Okay.
Stick with it.
So, you know, this is an appealing experiment.
Right.
That these kids were boys, of course, because this was, you know, 1908. So they were throwing these darts at this dartboard. The dartboard's underwater. Now, if you've studied GCSE physics, you know that where you see the board, the dartboard when it goes through the water is not where it really is. And if you throw the dart at what you can see, you'll miss. Yes. So they started out not being very good. Then they sort of learned, well, you have to aim higher than where you think the target is.
Okay.
And then you start to hit. And the treatment in this experiment was that half of them were told about the theory of refraction and how the light bends when it comes through the water and into the air. And the other half were just given the practice. They all had the practice time.
Okay.
Interesting fact number one about this study is that teaching them that theory about refraction and why it happens didn't make much difference to how accurate they were in the first part of the trial.
Mm-hmm.
So they all sort of started out bad, they were missing, and then they got their eye in and realized the adjustment, they made the adjustment, and they all had, both groups had about the same success rate.
Okay.
Interesting fact number two, though, is that they then changed the depth of the target.
Okay.
And at that point, the ones who'd been taught the theory were a lot better, or a lot quicker to adapt and more accurate than the ones who just sort of tried to make an adaptation without a theoretical rationale.
Because they understood why.
They understood why, and they could apply that meta theory, if you like, to a new case of a similar thing that wasn't quite the same, and therefore that's evidence for transfer.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Judd argued.
Okay.
So why is that interesting and important? I think because it tells us two things that we need to do to develop adaptive expertise. The first is that we need to practice the things that we want to get good at, to develop the routine expertise in a range of different ways, different contexts, different situations, different learning, you know, whatever it might be. So we vary the conditions of practice. Mm. But it's not enough just to vary the conditions of practice. We also have to develop, and therefore, I would say by implication, to teach explicitly an overarching theory about how you apply what you've learned from varying those conditions. So in my mind, I have a sort of two-dimensional space with dots. You know, here's two dimensions of practice that we're trying to vary, so along this axis and that one. And so here's an example of trying to do it. Here's another example. So we get lots of examples, but what we need to be able to do is to extrapolate or interpolate from the ones we know about to other ones that we haven't done yet. Right. That's the far transfer. And far transfer, obviously, if it's more extrapolating beyond what we've seen, that's far. If it's just, well, I've done these two and there's one in between, that's right. Pretty near transfer.
Okay.
So the real kind of prize in this game is to get far transfer that's really flexible.
Okay.
And I think the only way to get that is, yes, to have some variation of the conditions of practice, but also to have this overarching theory that explains why it changes as those conditions right. change.
So you've got to have some kind of a set of anchors, some kind of mental
yes,
model
exactly.
of
yeah.
whatever it is that you're trying to be good at,
yeah.
To keep you to give you the kind of the framework, and then you've got to have a way of practicing in varied conditions,
yeah.
So that you're kind of you're getting your eye in as
yes.
much as you can.
Yes.
I'm thinking of,
yeah.
of darts, although yeah. throwing darts in education is probably a bad idea. So you have lots and lots of opportunities for practice, but again, within a strong framework. So it's the connection of,
yes.
something that is, I'm pointing up here. I don't know if that's where it is, but a strong mental model.
Yes.
Plus lots of opportunities to,
yes.
to practice and to kind of yes. test your model and go,
yes.
does it work?
And I would say explicitly think about different levels of the mental model. So the mental model applies when you're doing each particular condition.
Yep.
Learning that skill, because you're part of what you're doing is you're thinking, well, what does really good success look like here?
Yeah, yeah.
How close to it am I? Measuring yourself up against it. All of that, I think, comes under the heading of a mental model.
Yes.
But you're also got this, if you want to call it a mental model, I would use the word theory, I think, which is maybe a bit grander.
It is.
That links all those different mental models
right.
together. So that's crucial.
Okay.
And then there's a couple of other things to say about that. So one is that I think the word adaptive itself can also have slightly different meanings,
mm-hmm.
Which are not particularly picked out in the literature, I don't think. But for me, so one of them is about this transferability, that you can take an idea that, not just do it in one case, but think about in a different situation, will it still work here?
Yep.
Can I optimize it, make it better by making this change? And related to that, I think implied in the word adaptable is a kind of sensitivity or responsiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I they certainly overlap, but
okay.
I think they are slightly distinct, that the ability to transfer your knowledge is not quite the
right.
same as the ability to sort of
yeah.
read a particular situation
okay.
and be responsive to it.
So, and that's where judgment and intuition
yep.
and what have you
yes.
sort of come into.
Okay. I think so. Yeah.
We're going to pick
yeah.
up on those
yeah.
in a minute. And in a minute, I'm going to ask you to try and give something concrete to this that says that let's bring this
yes.
into the classroom,
yeah, yeah,
into schools,
yeah,
and
yeah.
say what does this look like. But before we do that, let's just have a look at some of the questions or comments in there. A couple that here from Lee Davis. What Guy Claxton has referred to as floundering intelligently.
I quite
like the, or is that a description of what was just going on in this conversation? I don't know. A reference back to David Perkins' work from the early 90s,
okay.
Differentiating between tacit and aware and strategic and reflective.
Yes, I think there's a whole lot of different language that people have used. It doesn't quite map on perfectly, but they're getting at the same thing.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would say about all of this is none of it is really grounded in strong empirical science.
Right.
So in this chapter, for example, at the Hatano in Nagaki, there's no evidence cited.
Right.
There's no operationalization of, well, how would you, if you were watching a lesson or you were watching, in their context, you're watching a specific learner,
yep.
child,
well,
doing a particular thing, how would you decide whether what you're seeing is routine or adaptive?
Yep.
How would you decide whether right. it's the classroom, for example, is efficiency oriented or understanding oriented?
Yep.
And my view is that unless you've defined that process for deciding, you haven't really done the work of being clear about what the thing is yet.
Okay. Right.
And I don't think anyone has
okay.
either.
So then, right, but I'm trying to keep up with you. I feel I spend half my life trying to keep up with you. So adaptive expertise versus this thing called routine expertise, if I can be kind of present them on a continuum, but
yes.
try and differentiate.
Yeah, continuum's good.
Routine expertise we could somehow define as being the kind of expertise that means that you can perform a particular task, do something under the kind of normal conditions, conventional, consistent conditions.
Yeah.
What be that in the classroom
yeah.
that everything is, you know, as you predicted and as you practiced,
yeah.
which obviously never happens. And then the kind of adaptive expertise is the kind of expertise that allows you to flex within the dynamic and changing conditions
yeah.
and the unpredictable
yeah.
conditions of a classroom, but you're adapting in a way that is anchored to this mental model, this theory,
yeah.
So that you're kind of you're making good choices, but you're making them in the moment and responding to
yeah.
the needs and kind of emerging
yeah. Yeah.
context
yeah.
that you're in.
Yeah, I think that's.
And we're doing all right.
Yeah, I think we're doing all right. So let's take an example. Let's take something like doing a retrieval quiz.
Okay.
Let's say, for example, at the start of a lesson. Now, there are some people would tell you, here's what you do. Here's a recipe. Here's a five-step, people like, don't they? That's a kind of walkthroughs approach.
Yep.
So, and that all the quizzes, let's say, has to be a quiz, has to be multiple choice, has to be up on the board, has to be five questions, has to be this type of question.
Yep, yep.
You know, so there's quite a sort of prescriptive orthodoxy, let's say, about that.
Yes.
Other people might have a similarly tight set of rules, but they might be different rules.
Yep.
But however you do that, there's a big difference between hearing that and thinking, perhaps seeing someone else do it as well, you know, even really understanding well what it's meant to look like.
Yep.
And then going into your own classroom with, you know, real life children, trying it out and finding that it doesn't quite work in the way that it should have done on paper. Now, if you've ever been in the classroom, you've experienced that because,
yes.
You know, you can sort of play it through in your head. This is how it's going to work. As soon as it makes contact with reality,
yeah.
it doesn't
yep.
work. Of course
yep.
it doesn't. And part of that, a big part of that, I think, is just not having the skill to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be aspects of, you know, maybe the quiz wasn't, the questions weren't good, or maybe the way you delivered it wasn't good, or you just took too long to do it, so that although it's a learning opportunity, you know, half your lesson's gone before you even get started on something that was meant to be
yep.
retrospective. So there's all sorts of things. And if you, the first time you do it, you'll make those mistakes.
Yes.
You may realize you've made the mistake, or you may not, but certainly you could be helped to see that.
Yep.
And then you come back and you do it again, and you either make a different mistake, or you don't make mistakes, or you make them slightly less badly, or whatever.
Yep.
You keep getting that feedback, trying it again. And over a period of time, you get better at doing it.
Yep.
In exactly the same way that, you know, you explain to a class of children how to, I don't know, rearrange an equation or something like that. And some of them can just do it. Most of them can do a bit of it.
Yep.
They get stuck. You need to sort of nudge them along. Sometimes you need to backtrack a bit, give them an easier example. All of that kind of stuff that
yep.
teachers do to get to the point where the students can do this routine.
Yes.
And that's what we teach them to do. And then typically we make it a bit more complicated for them gradually in steps. Mm-hmm. So they build up to that. We give them lots of different types of equations to rearrange. And then when they've built up that routine expertise in a range of contexts, then often we'll come in with a more less well-defined, more open-ended problem, right, or something like that. And we'll, if they've understood the routine and can use it, they may well be able to apply it in a problem. But again, usually they need a little bit of a nudge to show them how this thing that they've learned in a particular context is relevant to that. It's the same kind of thing, I think, with teachers.
Yep.
That they can learn different ways of doing retrieval quizzes, for example, explicitly saying, right, well, you can do it as a multiple choice quiz, but you can also do it as a, you know, here's a blank sheet of paper, just write down five things you can remember about whatever. Or, you know, there are lots of other ways you can do it. Kate's written a fabulous book about it, more than one book, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, people can go away and read that, or other books are available.
Mm.
But the question is, let's say if you do it, so I suppose I do a retrieval quiz in a class and it absolutely bombs, it doesn't work at all. I have to try and work out why it didn't work and what I can do to save it if I'm going to try and do it again, which I should do because it's a good technique and it does work. So to do that, I need to understand the why.
Yes.
I need to, we talk about in the GTT, we talk about the why, how, when, and with what.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all the questions that teachers need to understand in order to be able to adapt their expertise or adapt their practice to the particular moment, to the context, to their children on that day with that topic, with that history of what they've done. And some of those things are plannable. You know what group it is, you know what you've done before, but some of it isn't. You know, just something happens that you didn't plan for, you didn't anticipate. Classrooms are quite chaotic places. Children don't behave the way you expect them to.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know, not in a bad way necessarily.
No, humans,
human beings,
their own thing.
They're unpredictable.
Yeah.
So the really flexible teacher with this adaptive expertise can just pivot on the fly without even noticing they've done it almost.
Yes.
Because they've got this inbuilt theory, internalized theory about how to, what to do and when to do it and why to do it.
Yeah.
And so it's a kind, it looks like an intuitive thing.
Yeah.
It looks quite automatic. It almost is in a way, but it's expertise.
Yeah. Okay. And so I want to pick up on some of the specifics about the ways in which the GTT kind of helps people with this. But there's a bit that you said there about the toolkit having this approach to the what, why, how, when, with what, all that kind of stuff.
Right? Why, how, when, and with what.
That's the one. Yeah. And it reminded me of something else that I'd read that was written about adaptive expertise. It was another Hatano piece. Talking about the kind of the idea of intrinsic motivation being linked to knowledge of why. So if you've got the procedural knowledge, you know, that's one thing. Okay, I know that you know the steps that I could take to do this.
Yes.
But I think the argument that I saw, and I can't remember how it was expressed exactly, was that as human beings we have this kind of desire for the why, and some of the intrinsic motivation that we have is satisfied by understanding the what's underneath the why. And I just wonder then in terms of this approach to developing adaptive expertise, if there's almost a benefit there around teachers and how they feel about the profession by understanding more of the why, feeling a bit more kind of attached and intrinsically motivated to it just by virtue of that. I don't know, it's not really a question comment.
I think that's right. I think that's really important. I think, again, I don't think there's great evidence to support that, but it rings intuitively absolutely true to me. It does resonate, I think, with theories of motivation that stress autonomy as being important. Yep. And for me, this is a really important aspect of this whole thing, which is that sometimes people get a bit anxious about autonomy.
Yes.
When they're talking about teachers' practice.
Yeah.
Because autonomy could mean a free for all.
Just do what you like.
Where everyone can just do bad things without any sort of challenge to that. Or not everyone. Yeah. You know, if you give people choice, sometimes people choose to do the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in the position of constraining that, then you have to you know, if you're a school leader, say, there's a tension there between, do I want to give people choice because it's empowering, it's motivating, it makes, it gives job satisfaction, and you know, everybody wants that.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I don't want that to mean everyone can just say, well, it works for me, I'm doing this.
Yes.
When actually it doesn't work for them.
Yep.
So I think expertise is the key that unlocks this puzzle,
right?
This conundrum,
yep,
this dilemma, the tension. Because if you believe that people have that expertise, mm-hmm, then of course you trust them with the autonomy to make those judgments.
Right.
And trust, I think, is an important word there. That trust is all about, or one of the dimensions of trust is the belief that people are competent.
Yes.
So if you believe that they have the skills necessary, that they can be trusted with autonomy to make their own choices, then I think you would do that. Yeah. You wouldn't try and stop them.
And alongside that, though, is a particularly that sort of bi-directional thing with trust, that alongside competence is reliability.
Yes.
So you've got what it takes to do the job, but also you're dependable in doing it.
Exactly.
I think, so this notion of like of expertise and trust seem to go kind of hand in hand.
Right? I think they're connected.
Right.
Yeah, I think they're definitely connected.
Okay.
I mean, there's a whole lot more to trust, obviously. It depends on a whole lot of things. But I do think that if we're talking about adaptive expertise, we are talking about having to hand over the power to teachers to make those decisions. You can't have adaptive expertise and then say, oh, but you have to do it like this to the letter.
But the crucial bit is that, you know, you said the expertise that's required is a kind of basis for thinking that you can trust people to make decisions and to make choices for themselves. But that expertise is in part based upon having that solid theory, theory. So you've got it. So it's you're making choice within a framework.
Exactly. It's not a free for all.
Yeah.
It's expertise.
Okay.
Which means you're an expert. Okay. And being an expert is not something you can just sort of click your fingers and say, oh, I'd like to be an expert tomorrow. Fine. Off you go. You know, lots of good work on this, Ericsson and others. You know, does it take 10 years or 10,000 hours? It certainly takes a lot of years and a lot of hours to become an expert in a complex thing. And there aren't many things that are more complex than classroom teaching in this universe.
Okay.
So I think it probably takes more than 10 years, or at least it's something that continues to develop, or can continue to develop for well over 10 years. Okay. Because there's just so much to learn.
Yeah.
There's another really interesting thing that Ericsson says, which is about that in some cases, developing routine expertise and automaticity can actually get in the way of genuine expertise, by which he means, I think, this more adaptive kind.
Mm.
Because as soon as something becomes automatic and fluent,
and
fluent and automatic, I think, are two sides of the same coin. Fluent means you're just doing it. You're not having to think hard.
Habitual.
It's quick and it's accurate,
automatic,
habitual. It's below the level of consciousness.
Yeah.
Then your ability to improve it and to do things like, you know, developing this overarching theory that links all these different bits together, because you're not, the cognitive process is not there,
right,
the cognitive expertise.
Okay.
So you have to explicitly draw people's attention,
yep,
make them think, make it sort of feel harder.
Yeah.
Make them think about what they're doing and why it's working, rather than just saying, off you go, do it, it's great.
Just do it like this.
Yeah.
And in a minute, I'm going to ask you to talk specifically about the ways in which the toolkit is trying to develop or help people to develop this adaptive expertise. But let's have a look at a couple of the questions and comments. So let's just go, let's pick one from back here. So Fee is saying, does far transfer refer to distance in epistemological terms and also in time terms, e.g. applying to a context that is superficially different and applying far away?
So there's a whole lot of dimensions of far, and most of the research on this, I'd say, is not that well conceptualized.
Yeah.
So it's not really clear. So that's a really good question.
Yeah.
Nice. There is a nice paper, actually. I've got made a note of Barnett and Sessi, 2002. It's called When and Where Do We Apply What We Learn? A Taxonomy for Far Transfer. So that one, I think, kind of sets it down and says we've had 100 years by that point. This is 2002, or pretty much 100 years of people talking about far transfer without quite yet defining what it means. And here are, I think, about six dimensions to talk about, which include in the kind of the type of task or the context in which it's done or the time difference. Yeah. And so there's all these things are in there. Yeah, they're all important.
Thank you for your question. Nice question. And then so Mark's saying, if we don't understand the why, as to why a particular task didn't work, and plow on anyway, we're in danger of eliciting a lethal mutation of the strategy. Yep. Are we suggesting only altering the strategy for a particular group or for all? Okay, so that notion of then plowing on and just and things bit by bit eroding from and lethally mutating and all that kind of stuff.
I think the answer is it depends on the why, whether it can be tweaked to make it work, whether actually you did nothing wrong. It's just, sometimes things work, sometimes they don't. You do exactly the same thing. The same, even a really skilled expert teacher can have a bad lesson, actually, where it doesn't work. So sometimes there isn't a why, but again, I think experience can give you that, okay, well, I'm not going to go and beat myself up or change my whole pedagogy here.
Yeah.
I'm just going to have a cup of tea and good night's sleep. I'll come back, fight again tomorrow, and it'll be fine.
Okay. Please keep questions coming and also suggestions. And thank you to Ian for the suggestion of a future talk about what are the main barriers for students and teachers to gaining adaptive expertise? Does it depend on the individual or other trends and so on?
Yeah.
So, how do we get more of it? I suppose let's get stuck into
that. That brings it back to the GTT and our thinking about this.
All right.
So first of all, just to repeat, I don't think there's great evidence about how either what it is in kind of clear definition that's operational and useful, or good knowledge about how we get more of it.
Right.
And as I say, this debate still goes on, I think, in the context of particularly maths education. Do we need to start with procedural? Do we start with conceptual? Do we start with both? Can you have one without, all of that stuff still goes on. And so we know even less about that in relation to professional learning.
Mm-hmm.
But so what we're trying, one of the things we're trying to do, which underpins the sort of meta theory of the whole GTT, is to learn more about what things work when they work.
Yep.
So that we start out by looking at the evidence, we choose what we think is the most sensible, the best evidence approach that we can based on what we already know. What we already know is not complete, it's not adequate, but it's as good as we've got, so mm-hmm. we have to start somewhere. But if we build learning into the system, then when we try that out, we can do the adaptive expertise thing of trying to work out, well, why hasn't it worked? Or we can do sort of comparisons, A-B type testing, that kind of thing. So all of that's underpinning what we do and we're going to learn. And what we definitely need to do is come back in 5 years and say, aha, here's what we've learned.
Yep.
We now know how to get adaptive and routine expertise, because you need both.
Yeah.
Okay, so I would say our best bet, what we're starting from, is the idea that, you need both. So you need to focus on the skills, which is being able to do the thing well, doing it fluently, doing it accurately, doing it efficiently and effectively. So mm-hmm. let's say doing a retrieval quiz that does actually work. It gets kids to retrieve stuff and helps them to put down those memories in ways that they can then recall.
Mm-hmm.
Recall and connect, of course, not just parrot them back,
but
connect them to other knowledge. Okay, so being able to do it effectively, that's the skill.
Mm-hmm.
But being able to answer the why, how, when, and with what, that's the understanding.
Right. Well,
understanding is the word that I tend to use around it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people like to talk about knowledge, or we've also talked about judgment.
Yep.
Which doesn't mean sort of evaluative, that was very good, that wasn't good.
Yeah.
It means making a sort of complex, nuanced decision,
judgment.
Decision. In that sense.
So how would I get these, I'm there in the toolkit.
Okay.
And I want to,
got an account, you've logged in.
Yeah, and I'm trying to
what are you gonna do?
Build my knowledge and my understanding, but also my skills. So it's those kind of, I want the mental model and the theory.
Yeah.
But I also want.
So I think they develop together is how we're trying to think about it. So we've got courses in there, which are and resources of other kinds, things you can read and think about. So that gets the kind of cognitive side of this going, the theory, if you like. It builds the theory, explicitly builds the theory. If you've done one of the courses, you'll know that it doesn't just present lots of knowledge, it connects it all together so that you can answer these why, how, when, and with what questions.
Yep.
In an abstract sense, yes, but that's what theory does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then we also need teachers to identify, and they might do some of that theory first, if you like. So they might start with a course that gives them that grounding, gives them that knowledge, or they might go to the resource area and, you know, pick out a blog or something like that. That's a bit more short and sweet than mm-hmm. a course, which are quite intensive. But, you know, as I said, this is expertise. It's big. It takes years to learn.
Yep,
so
yep.
No apologies
for
it being intensive. So if you start with that, that gets you thinking about the kinds of things that are important mm-hmm. and how things work and so on. And you're bound to reflect on your own practice
mm-hmm.
and think about, oh, well, okay, maybe I could work on this thing.
Yep.
You might also do what we've put under the heading of feedback, which is to get insights into what's going on in your classroom.
Yep.
Obviously, you're in your classroom, so you're perceiving it.
Yep.
But in general, my view is you don't perceive it very well.
Yep.
You can't see yourself. Self-evaluation is generally terrible, really hard to do well, mostly.
So you can get some feedback.
So you are the agent in that classroom. You're in that classroom every day. But anyone who's ever watched a video of themselves teaching will appreciate that it's just mind-blowing. You do not see the stuff that is picked up on video.
Yeah.
And often it's horrific because the narrative you've got in your head is much better than the one that you see on the video. So you need to be
reasonably you quickly get used to it, though.
Brave and robust.
When you've done it, you really do get used to it very quickly.
And, you know, it's not about you and your ego and your sort of protecting your sense of here's what I am and I'm doing a great job. It's about a professionalism that says you want to be even better than you are.
Yep.
You owe it to the other colleagues you work with, to the children that you serve, the communities. Mm-hmm. That is the job. If you're a professional, you should want to get better. Yep. Even though you're already great, you should still want to get better.
And that kind of getting feedback, just to dwell on that, it's pretty common in sports, in other professions, to kind of get that really granular feedback on practice.
Yeah. So it's a cultural thing, I think, a lot. And some people are really up for it. Others would rather just do anything painful.
Yeah, yeah. But increasingly, I'm seeing more and more schools using video, more and more teachers engaging with it, and benefiting from it as a kind of a tool for reflection, you know, with groups, with colleagues, to kind of pick it apart, and you're not reliant just on a memory or on one person's observation and opinion and written down things. You've got an artifact.
Yeah, you've got a record, and you can have a discussion about that with two people or more than two people who've all seen the same thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, human beings, they can all see the same thing but see things really differently.
Yeah, totally.
That's just how people are. So feedback is important in that.
Yep.
And we've also got student surveys in there, so you can ask the children what they think. And,
you
know, we don't ask them, do you like this?
Yeah.
We ask them, does your teacher ever do this? Those kinds of questions.
Yeah, a bit more kind of objective.
Yeah, it's related to the things that we know make a difference to learning. So, which is not, you know, do children like you? We don't ask about that because it's not relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So the feedback tools come in there, thinking about your own practice. And the other thing I would say crucially about this is that this is done collectively. It's a collaborative endeavor.
Yep.
So you talked about getting better together. Getting better together means teachers working together, helping each other.
Yeah.
And this, for me, this wasn't part of the original conception, because I just thought, well, classroom teachers, you've got these skills, you've got this understanding. If you can just build up the skills and understanding, off you go, you're a better teacher. And then we started working with some teachers, and quite quickly, even I worked this out quite quickly, which is that if they weren't collaborating to do that, it pretty much didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't do it on your own. It's too hard. You can't sustain the motivation, the effort.
Yep.
You can't even get the sort of learning and the insights. So we have to find ways to help teachers to collaborate effectively and notice also not all collaboration is good. Some collaboration is terrible. It can be, you know, a really dreadful time sink that makes you want to tear your hair out if you have any because it just doesn't work.
Yes.
So how we frame that collaboration is really important.
Yep.
But if we frame it well so it's focused on helping teachers to make decisions about what am I going to work on? And that means something specific about your practice that will be a visible change. I'll be able to come back in 3 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever, and I will see the difference.
Yep.
So it will be cognitive as well, yeah. But it's practical.
Yep.
Okay. So I commit to this group. And that's another thing about the group is that
yeah.
I don't just think, oh, well, I might just have a go at that.
Yeah.
I, you know, say it to my trusted colleagues. I'm going to work on this thing. I'm going to get better at this thing. And here's some video of me doing it now. If
yeah.
I'm feeling quite brave. In 3 weeks' time, I'm going to do that again. 3 weeks' time, I'm going to do it again. And in this group, we'll sit around and we'll look at it and we'll discuss it.
Yeah.
And those discussions, if they're informed
yes.
by good theoretical good theory. Knowledge, if there's enough expertise in the group
yeah.
and the expertise is recognized in the group, so yeah. it's not just, so in a sense, the loudest voices are also the ones you most want to hear,
yeah.
which again, isn't always the case in every group.
Yeah.
But if we can help to make that the case, then those right. conversations, we hope, are really productive and also really efficient.
Yes.
So we're not talking about having to, yeah. you know, devote half a day every week to
yeah,
having
yeah.
these meetings. We're talking about, yeah, yes. real schools don't really have that amount of time.
No.
So it's a tiny amount that they could, you know, regular meetings, again, yeah. much, much harder to find the time for. But I think where schools can say, this is in the calendar, you know, it's an hour a fortnight or an hour a half term or whatever they can manage,
yeah.
then that can work.
Yeah. And those feedback tools are the very things that help you to make those conversations efficient and,
yes,
and effective.
Exactly.
And if you've got that background theory that's
yeah.
always there with the model for great teaching and, you know, what have you. But then day to day, you've got granular feedback
yeah.
from students in the form of video or from colleagues or whatever. And so in the way, the whole thing is an expertise building conversation.
Exactly. That's the hope.
And increasingly, I mean, I don't know what numbers we're up to now, but with student surveys, you know, like over 50,000,
yeah,
I know,
something like that yeah.
of
yeah.
those have been done.
Yeah.
And you know, and so those things are happening now with people
yeah.
using the toolkit. And crucially, I think what I'm seeing is that the toolkit doesn't, you know, it doesn't put the kind of pendulum of it has to either go to it's
yes.
all conceptual knowledge
yeah.
and theory, or it's all skills and, you know, and step-by-step approaches to things.
Yeah.
It's a flexible
yeah.
Amalgamation of those things. And I've seen in individual schools within groups where they're using it very differently
yeah.
in different schools
yeah,
because
completely.
The needs are different.
It is very, very flexible.
Yeah.
But the key idea, I think, is that if to walk, you know, it's better if you can walk on both feet.
Yeah.
You need the balance.
Yes.
You don't just put your emphasis on one and hop. You
yeah.
use both feet, and that's a more
yeah.
Efficient way to get around.
That's an interesting metaphor. We'll pick that one up on another day. So let's pick up on some comments and questions, and let's zip back. So just a comment there. Trust is also related to allowing teachers to explore and actively
yes.
research within expert parameters, yes,
yeah.
either their own or provided by others, so that they can discover why. This is it. This
yeah.
is exactly
yeah. Yeah.
what the toolkit is set up to do. I think of it as I'm a big fan of Desert Island Discs.
Oh yeah,
and there is this. Don't worry, go with me.
Have you got your eight?
No, well, I've not, because I don't. You know, come on. If only one day. I'm open to invitations, but Miranda Hart was on there, and she was asked about how she liked to spend her holidays. And she said she liked to, and I quote, relax within a structure.
Okay.
And
yeah,
that's kind of what we're talking about here, is that you've got a framework and you can choose within a structure,
yeah,
but the
yeah,
structure
yeah.
is there.
I mean, there's so much
guide.
Again in that, the idea that you feel empowered to explore.
Yes.
So, and to fail, I think, by implication.
Yep.
Or, you know, other people will use softer words for that. But I think, you know, that's the risk.
Yeah, you have a go.
If you're allowed to innovate, with that comes the possibility that
yeah.
what you do doesn't work.
Yes.
And that's fine. That's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
It has to be okay. I mean,
yeah.
if you keep on doing it and it doesn't work, that's not
yeah.
okay.
But that's where you need feedback.
But yes, the feedback.
And you need it at the point
yeah.
you need it.
Yeah.
Not when somebody else
yeah.
says that you can have it.
Yeah.
That's the crucial thing,
yes.
I think, for me.
Yeah.
We're going to wrap up in a couple of minutes, but just looking at some other comments. So Mark saying there are big crossovers in practice with Ebbinghaus's forgetting curve and the theory of disuse. So that's a Bjork thing and the new theory of disuse in terms of retrieval and storage strength. Are we to expect collateral damage of poor results while we develop more FAR transfer?
Yes, a good question. I don't know, is the answer. So it may be that there is a trade-off between sort of short-term wins and longer-term wins. That you build that expertise with a really secure foundation by doing things that maybe don't get the best outcomes for, you know, in the next 6 months or whatever the short horizon is. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a really
interesting, it's a scaffolded approach. I think that's the kind of, you know, the framework is there to give you the best bets of where to focus your attention.
Yeah. I mean, I'd be surprised if there's a big cost there, because the way we try and frame it again within the GTT is that there's very much a focus on practical change, so practical skills, practical activity, a teacher changing their practice. So we're not saying, oh, you have to go away and read these 20,000 books before you can start to make a change. Get in there quick. And in particular, the idea of these sort of cycles where you identify a change you want to make, you plan the change you're going to make, you share it, all of this shared within the group, you make the change, and then you discuss how well it's gone. And that the first time you do that should be quite a quick cycle. So don't try and change anything too ambitious the first time. Make it something that you know you can do just to get the feel for that process. And then when you've been through that a few times, then you might say, right, well, I'm going to tackle something that's even more challenging and big and hairy. And that's fine again.
Yeah.
But by then you've got some momentum going and maybe improved some things already.
And also,
so you've sort of bought yourself the space to do this.
But you've also bought yourself the model of getting better.
Exactly.
You've got into this habit of setting goals, building understanding, developing your skills, and thus that becomes, hopefully the one of the roles that the GTT plays is it develops this kind of habitual approach to getting better that doesn't require so much thought.
Yes.
And, you just do it.
So you become
already got that
an adaptive expert at improvement.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. We set this up initially as a lampside chat. There's the lamp to talk about adaptive expertise and what have you. And I'd like to say thank you to all of you who've joined us today, and thanks for people putting questions into the Q&A panel. Really, really great questions, actually. And sorry we haven't been able to get to all of those. As Rob has said, our whole toolkit project is one part evidence-informed professional learning and one part research project to learn about how teachers get better at teaching. And so keep watching the space for more as we publish more on what we learn. But also, if you have suggestions for other sessions, if you liked this model, we've never done this before, have we?
No.
The lampside chat. If you like it, then please, drop us a line. You'll get a follow-up email with the recording and so on. And if there are other topics that you think are of interest and you want to suggest that we get stuck into, then we'd be very happy to consider that. We're in a dynamic world of change in education, and I think of this this topic of adaptive expertise almost as a protective factor for teaching. When we're thinking particularly in contexts in the US, for instance, in the UK and in other parts of the world where recruiting and retaining teachers is a real challenge, we need to find ways that are helpful for development, that are motivating, that keep people interested, and that notion of understanding the why seems fundamental to that, but that allow people to develop these kind of the protective factor of adaptive expertise in context. That means that whatever curriculum, qualifications, societal changes we have to cope with, we're always working from a strong theory, a strong mental model of what great teaching looks like and can be, with a really clear way of getting better together. So thank you all for joining us today. Look out for the next one of these, and we will conclude there. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Yeah.